So this sermon, we're starting Daniel chapter 11. So let me tell you something, just to freak you out to begin with. I had 32 pages of single-spaced, small-print notes for this sermon, okay? Spent 2 weeks on it and hours upon hours upon hours on this sermon. This is probably the most researched and longest sermon I've ever worked on. And so you guys are probably sitting there going, oh no, this is going to be a really long sermon. And you're going to be right. It is going to be a long sermon. And unfortunately, it's going to be with a lot of history and a lot of facts. But we were determined we were going to do Daniel. We're going to get through it. And so I know that you're going to want to probably nod off everyone out there except for Hugh, who loves history. And it's a lot of history. We're going to move quickly because it's a sermon. But I'll tell you what, I'm just hoping that while you're looking at this particular lesson, and it is more of a lesson than it is a sermon, I admit, but I'm hoping that when you look at it, that you'll look at the detail of this vision that Daniel got, and you'll just be in awe of it. You'll be in awe of what God has done, and just be amazed. So if you'll hold with me just a little bit on this lesson, I think you'll probably enjoy it. Might even get something out of it. So we're going to talk to... The host has spotlighted your video for everyone. Would you like to join audio to speak? And in the first year of Darius the Mede, we're at 11 verse 1, I took my stand, I being Daniel here, took my stand to support and protect him. So this is Darius the First. The year is 522 BC, and Daniel is at least 88 years old here. Now, I'm going to have like a timeline kind of in this, and every now and then you're going to see a date, and it's going to give you an idea of the timeline that we're working in and how vast amount of time that we're dealing with. Okay? Verse 2. Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia, and then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. So the three kings were Xerxes the First, 486 to 465 BC, Artaxerxes II, 465 to 424 BC, Darius II, 423 to 404 BC, and the fourth king was Artaxerxes II, who made war with Greece from 404 to 358 BC. Okay? Then a mighty king will arise, who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. This is going to be Alexander the Great from 356 to 323 BC. He attacks Persia out of revenge for Artaxerxes' attack. He attacks on Greece, their attacks on Greece, okay? Verse 4. And he has risen. His empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. So Alexander died in 323 BC. His kingdom is divided to his four generals, the four winds. His brother, wives, and children were killed. So his family line is totally cut off, just as we saw in that verse. The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with greater power. So the southern king was his general, okay? I'm thinking that the name is Lagus there, Ptolemy Lagus, who ruled over Egypt. His commander was Seleucus Nicator, who ended up ruling Syria, Babylon, and Media, 305 BC. Okay, so after some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his and his power will not last. In those days, she will be betrayed, and together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her. So following the peace agreement of 253 BC between Egypt and Syria to end the Second Syrian War, and this whole passage is kind of dealing with the Syrian wars, and there was like six of them. So there's six Syrian wars. So this is the second one where there's an agreement and there's a peace treaty, okay? Philadelphus gave his daughter Bernice in marriage to Antiochus, who later killed her and their sons, so she did not retain her power, and all those that were with her, her servants, her whole entourage that went with her to part of this marriage. Verse 7 says, one from her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. So her brother, Euergetes, marched out with a great army in vengeance of his sister being murdered and was victorious. And now we're at 246 to 241 BC. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold, and carry them off to Egypt. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. Daniel 11:8. So, he took away 4.4 million in silver and gold, images, and about 2,500 gods. A revolt broke out in Egypt, and he returned home to deal with unrest. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country. Because Ptolemy did not crush the Seleucids completely, they recaptured many of their cities. By 245 BC, they had recaptured Mesopotamia and even entered into land controlled by Egypt. Conflict ends with another peace treaty. Verse 10, his sons were prepared for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Seleucus' son, Cyrenius, assembled a great army, but was assassinated. His second son, Antiochus the Great, took the army and regained Syria. Defeating Egypt's general, Nicholas, he stood ready to invade Egypt. Then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north. Now, y'all are getting this, right? The king of the south is Egypt. The king of the north is the Seleucid Empire. So then the king of the south will march out in rage and fight against the king of the north. He will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. So Philopater went out to face Antiochus and defeats him in 217 BC. Then the army is carried off. The king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands, yet he will not remain triumphant. At the end of summer, okay, Ptolemy invaded Seleucid Syria, forcing Antiochus to accept a peace treaty, regaining the territory lost. He returns to Egypt victoriously, but uprisings in Egypt lead to his downfall. For the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years, he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. 14 years later, in 203 BC, after Ptolemy the IV died, Antiochus returns with a greater army to conquer Egypt. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. Those who are violent among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. So Ptolemy the VI, who won Jewish favor by opening up the whole of Egypt to the Jews on whom he relied, yet united with King Philip of Macedonia, Antiochus sought to plunder Egypt, and some Jews joined him. So in the first little war that we saw there, we saw that the reason Egypt didn't win was because there were some internal issues that were happening within his kingdom. And in fact, there was kind of a revolution. Some of the working class were kind of trying to go against the king and establish their own government. So Ptolemy ended up hiring a bunch of Jews who came down to try to help kind of get things taken care of and defend the country. And so because they came and helped, he kind of opened up Egypt to them. He even gave them land to build a temple. And this started to win him favor with the Jews. So that's where we are right now, okay? But even with that, there was a verse. Remember the scripture said that some tried to fulfill the vision? Well, in Isaiah, there is a scripture where God is upset about the fact that the Jews align themselves with the Egyptians. And he kind of calls them out on that. So some of the Jews point to Isaiah, say, hey, we have to do something about that because they're aligning with Egypt and God doesn't like that. And so they ended up aligning themselves with Antiochus. So some of the Jews ended up joining Antiochus to plunder Egypt. See how that worked? So then the king of the north will come and build siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. And the forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. So Antiochus decides to take Judea. Ptolemy sent his general to oppose him, but was defeated near the falls of Jordan. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land. The beautiful land is Israel, by the way, and will have the power to destroy it. So Antiochus enters Jerusalem. The Jews who had rebelled against Egypt assist him. They actually kind of help tear down the ramparts and defenses. Now, they don't realize what they're doing, but they're setting this up that now Antiochus will have control over them. So verse 17 says, he will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. So again, these two kingdoms that are constantly battling, they're going to try again to make a peace treaty through a marriage. After Antiochus the Great won Israel, he became embroiled in war with Rome. Because he was embroiled in this Rome with Rome, he didn't want a two-front war. So he kind of wants the Egyptians to stay neutral and stay out of the war. And he wants to secure that border. So he decides to do this treaty. And he gives his daughter, Cleopatra I, to Ptolemy in marriage. I always thought Cleopatra was Egyptian. Turns out she's Syrian, and she marries an Egyptian. So now you know. And there's going to be a Cleopatra II later who will be born of this lineage. And in fact, the later Cleopatra is the one that's going to be with Julius Caesar and all that you see so much about the movies. But this is the first Cleopatra, and she is the daughter of Antiochus the Great, and she's been given in marriage to Egypt. And he kind of thinks that she will do his bidding. She's going to keep that Ptolemy in check, that king, and then she'll probably end up helping Syria and be loyal, may even cause problems within the kingdom. She, however, sides with her husband and becomes a queen of Egypt. Verse 18 says, then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. But a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back on him. So Antiochus fitted out a great fleet of 100 large ships and 200 smaller vessels. But he is defeated by a consul. So here's the vast, pompous Antiochus. He's so great. And he's basically defeated by what we would call a captain, okay? By Consul Manius Aquilius Glaberio. The names are hard on these, so y'all have to bear with me. After this, he will turn back towards the fortress of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. So he was totally humiliated by this Roman consul, okay? And because he's totally humiliated and he loses, he's kind of in run for his life, which is why he goes back to his own fortress, all right? And he really is just a series of stumbles from here. He's never going to recover from this. So Antioch escaped back to Syria. He eventually made it back to his own fort, Antioch. He then sent ambassadors and was forced to pay tribute to Rome. He eventually was assassinated. The manner of his death is actually unknown. So kind of the idea of, you know, don't really know about him. Verse 20 says, his successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. So the reference here is no doubt his son, Seleucus Philopater, now bound to pay Rome tribute. He raised taxes on his people. In fact, he's known as the tax raiser in history. He did not reign as long as his dad, and he was poisoned in 175 BC. It's not good to be the king. Always getting killed. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel insecure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Verse 21. Philopater and his son were assassinated by Herodias, who then seizes the throne for himself. And he was not part of the royal lineage, so therefore he was not supposed to be the king. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and the prince of the covenant will be destroyed. Well, this was fascinating reading, by the way. With the help of King Eumenes II of Pergam, Herodias is overthrown. Antiochus Epiphanes becomes emperor. Through a series of bribes, the high priest, Onanias III, is replaced by Jason, and then Menelaus of Bilov. While awaiting an audience to protest Menelaus, the old priest, Onias, is killed. So the prince of the covenant, because he was a high priest, he was a Levite who was in line to be the high priest of the temple, he was in charge of the covenant, the law, Moses. And he was the one who was lost because he was assassinated. He was actually murdered. Verse 23 says, after coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. Antiochus starts off small at first, but soon grows in power because of a few well-chosen alliances. And it's amazing, actually, how he gets into power. Because when his dad lost and was on the run, and in order to keep from being killed by Rome, he agrees to pay tribute. Well, to keep him in line, they ask for him to send one of his sons to be a hostage in Rome. And so he sends his son, Antiochus, to be one of the hostages in Rome. So just kind of so you know that. Verse 24, when the richest province feels secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. So he began to engage in conquest. So this guy who had been a hostage in Rome works his way back. He finds out that his brother and his family has been killed by Herodias. So he, with intrigue and treaties and working it, he ends up getting himself on the throne. Okay? And he begins, after he gets the throne, to immediately engage in conquest. He just picks up where his dad left off. So Polybus and said that Antiochus Epiphanes was every man's companion. He was like a madman. He was like this brilliant genius. He would sometimes go into the streets. He'd throw out handfuls of money. He was liberal with gift to his friends. And he would kind of divide up land. Verse 25. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. So Egypt, seeing that Syria is kind of in turmoil, the Seleucid kingdom and empire is kind of in turmoil with all this intrigue that's going on, and Antiochus just now establishing himself, he decides to attack. So he attacks Antiochus, but he doesn't realize that Antiochus is prepared for war. He's already kind of wanting to get in there, and he's already prepared an army to like invade Egypt. So Ptolemy is caught off guard, but intrigue within his own government causes him to lose. So because they kind of get caught off guard and they realize that Antiochus is more prepared than they think, there's kind of this infighting that takes place, and that division ends up causing their fall. Verse 26, those who eat from the king's provision will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. And this is another issue. Ptolemy's the sixth reign was difficult because of an internal conflict with his younger brother for control of the monarchy. Literally, those who ate at the king's table could be treacherous, and many were bribed. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because the end will still come at the appointed time. So Ptolemy, realizing he's in trouble now, seeks out a peace treaty with Antiochus. He wants to try to make peace. After all, Antiochus is his uncle. Remember, Bernice was given to Mary, so she's from the Seleucid Empire. But the two kings would sit and lie to each other, and this is actually documented in history, as Antiochus stirred the rift between the brothers to his advantage as much as he could. Verse 28, the king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. So while engaged in peace talks, Antiochus is delayed in coming back. Meanwhile, the Jews received a false report that Antiochus was dead. And so they emboldened, they revolt against him and replace his high priest Menelaus, remember, who they kind of are angry with because he had the real high priest killed. So they kind of revolt and they remove him. But when Antiochus returns, he's enraged that his high priest has been removed, and so therefore he attacks Jerusalem. So enraged by this news, that's the news he's enraged by, his loss of Egypt, he attacks Jerusalem. 29, at the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. These two kingdoms just can't leave each other alone. So Antiochus invades Egypt a second time and is successful this time. It's a different outcome. And he begins to march towards Alexandria. We're at 169 BC. Ships of the western coastlines will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So hearing ships had arrived from Rome, remember, he's on his way to Alexandria. He's about to conquer all of Egypt. But he hears their ships that arrived from Rome with delegates from the Senate who he went to see them. Gaius, and I'm not going to get all the rest of that name, emerged with a letter from Rome telling Antiochus to return home and leave Egypt alone. Literally, this is where that line in the sand comes from. This is where this expression takes place. Because when Gaius approaches him, he tells him, and he reads the letter, and he says, Rome says for you to leave Egypt alone or they're going to attack you. And Antiochus stalls for time, and he says, well, let me think about how I need to respond to Rome. He tries to just kind of, you know, placate them a little bit. and I will give my answer, because Gaius says you have to give your answer. So he's telling him, just give me a little time of how to word this, and I'll get back to you. You know what the Gaius says? He literally takes a stick, and he draws a line in the sand around him, and he tells him not to leave that circle without an answer. So now here's Antiochus, who thinks himself somewhat of a god, is basically being told, you know, here's the line in the sand. If you leave it, we're going to attack, and you will answer before you leave. And he's kind of embarrassed by this whole thing. Anyway, he says he will comply. He's a little afraid of Rome, so he says that he will do it, and he stops his attack. But in fury, he leaves Egypt because he's so upset, and he attacks Jerusalem on the way home. We're at 167 B.C. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifices. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. So Antiochus built an idol altar. He attacks Jerusalem and he builds an altar upon God's altar. And he slew swine upon it, which, you know, pigs are forbidden. It's an unclean animal in the covenant. So for him to have deliberately done pigs was really an insult. And he offered a sacrifice to the god Jupiter. And he forbids the Jews to do any kind of daily sacrifice. He literally stops the sacrifices. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. So there's an effort to Hellenize the Jews at this point, and to get them to embrace other gods. And so he kind of tells them that they have to start worshiping other gods, and they're supposed to use pig bloods when they do it. And those who kind of want to be Hellenized, that want to be free, kind of be more modern, they kind of go along with him. So with flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. But there's some faithful people here, see? So he compelled them to forsake the worship of their god and to adore his gods, and made them build temples and raise idol altars in every city and village and offer swine upon them every day. And that faithful group starts to resist his commands. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. So the faithful are going to go under incredible miseries. They are whipped with rods and their bodies are torn to pieces. They're crucified. If they have their sons circumcised, which was the law, their sons were killed. Copies of the sacred book of the law, if they were found, were destroyed. But the family called the Maccabees begins to rise up. And this is where they're in revolt, and they're teaching others, and they're starting to fight against him. And they do a guerrilla-type warfare against Antiochus because they know they can't confront him directly. And this is going to go on about a couple of years. So when they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. So many Jews complied with the king's command. They fall, either because they lack faith or out of fear. But those who comply, God is basically saying in this prophecy, they can expect little help from the Lord because they made their decision. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined. This is important to us because even today, Christians face these kind of decisions when they're in countries where there's persecution. Who knows, we may have to face these decisions. So we need to understand the importance of it. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined. So when this time of trial and persecution and testing comes, it's so that we can be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. So it's a time of testing. God is kind of telling them up front. He's kind of warning them. This is going to happen. It's going to take place. Remember, Daniel's going to be written down. So he's telling them well in advance to expect it. And he's telling them why it's happening. Because how many times do we ask that question? Why, Lord? Why are we going through it? Why is it taking place? Some will fail. Others will not. They are being purified. It's not yet time for judgment. Verse 36. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed. But what has been determined must take place. You know, it's so hard sometimes when we see people do things against God's people, and it seems like they're successful, like everything they do, they're just rewarded, things go well for them. It's very frustrating for us Christians, am I right? It's hard to see that other people seem to be doing well when we know that they're doing wrong. But there's a time determined for them, and that's the reason. Remember, God's in control, and nothing happens without him allowing it. There is a plan. So Antiochus seems successful in his efforts over Israel. His name, by the way, means illustrious one or God manifest. He wasn't born with that name. It's a name he assumed. So he exalts himself as a god. His days are numbered, however. He will show no regard for the gods of his ancestors or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Antiochus actually ended up rejecting the Greek gods. Remember, the Seleucid Empire is a Greek empire, and so he rejects the Greek gods. He was a respecter of no god, really. In fact, he really just used gods in order to get wealth, because the temples would collect money or things, and then he would raid those temples to fill his coffers. And he rejected also the goddess of heaven, Ashtar, who was revered by women, because that gave them some sorts of power, so that he rejected that. He exalted himself. That's who he really exalted. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortress, a god unknown to his ancestors, and I have a theory why. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. This seems to be Jupiter Olympius, known among the Phoenicians and Romans by the name of Baal. Does that sound familiar? The Lord of the sky, the Lord of fortresses, but never introduced among the Syrians until Antiochus introduced it. This god was known to receive wealth. Okay? Remember, Antiochus was a hostage there in Rome. When his dad died, he was no longer needed, so he was released. But while there, he probably learned about the Roman gods and Jupiter. This is what's really cool, okay? Jupiter didn't get sacrifices like everybody else. He didn't do cows and pigs and all that. In order to worship him, you threw money into the coffers. He accepted silver and gold and precious metals. So it would make sense that Antiochus would maybe promote Jupiter, because then the money is coming into the coffers, and then he was known to raid those coffers. Verse 39, he will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price. So Antiochus was known to give land to those who aided him. Those who recognized his authority would be placed into power, but definitely with a cost. At the time of the end, verse 40, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. So Antiochus then mounted a campaign against the Perithians, who were threatening the empire. He then set out on an expedition to the Arabian coast. He hears Judas Maccabees has defeated his army in Jerusalem while he is on that expedition. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. So here's where it starts to get sticky. Some people still feel that this is still Antiochus. And I mean, I spent hours trying to mesh this out. And the truth of the matter is he doesn't go back and invade. He starts to go back to invade, but he dies before he gets there, Jerusalem. Now, he did send a general in, so it's possible that the general would represent him, and therefore, when it says he invades, it might have been the general who was trying to put down that rebellion. And many countries, by the way, in that campaign with Perithians, because he's successful with them, do fall. and not any of the countries listed. However, some people think that this he is a switch, and it may be referring to the Roman Empire or even to some future king like an Antichrist. And here's why. Okay, so it's possible this refers to Rome, who did conquer many lands. They will invade Israel in 63 BC, and Pompey led that attack. And this is where they conquer Israel. He will extend his power over many countries, and Egypt will not escape. The person who really did that is going to be Pompey from Rome. He's working as in conjunction. This is the Roman Empire. He's working with, actually, Julius Caesar. They're kind of co-reigning rulers. There's actually a tetrarch. There's three rulers. It's going to end up at the very end being Julius Caesar, who will take it to the Roman Republic Empire. But anyway, he will extend his power over many countries, and the three of them did under the Roman Empire, and Egypt did not survive the Roman aggression. In fact, Egypt falls to Rome in 31 BC. Antiochus never actually conquered Egypt. He came close, but Rome stopped him, remember? So it says here, Egypt will not escape. So maybe it's not a conqueror. It could still be Antiochus, who maybe he did do another attempt at an invasion. It doesn't say necessarily they conquered, but it's more likely referring to Rome at this point. Verse 43. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt with Libyans and Cushites in submission. Again, this seems to point more towards Rome. Rome carried away Egypt's riches. Libya was actually bequeathed. Remember it says Libya's in submission? Was bequeathed to Rome by the last Greek ruler. So while not occupied by Rome, there was a puppet king who was established that ruled there. And so they were in submission to Rome. The Cushites were actually Africans. In particular, they're kind of known to be Ethiopians. And while Rome didn't really have a conquering of Ethiopia, they went into Africa. They actually went across the whole top of Africa, if you look at a map. And so if the Cushites are Africans, it would talk about that there was some submission there. In other words, they're not opposing Rome. They're kind of complying with Rome, not wanting to be attacked. So Rome did conquer parts of Africa. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. Much is debated on this verse. Again, some keep still referring that these last few verses are still referring to Antiochus. So they say that when he heard the news, that was when he heard about Jerusalem, and he kind of gets upset. He kind of goes off in anger to conquer. Of course, he doesn't quite finish when he hears that Jerusalem has fallen. But others see it as Rome, and it may actually be Pompey, who also died near the sea. Both of them died near the sea. Pompey was kind of embroiled in a civil war with Julius Caesar at this point. He kind of was marching off to try to conquer lands himself in order to gain power so he could, and he was fighting Julius Caesar, and he ended up being assassinated near the sea. But others still think this is referring to a future event, and it's the Antichrist. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas, and remember I said both of them were assassinated near seas, between the seas and the beautiful holy mount. Well, Antiochus, we're not really sure how he died. According to Maccabees, God struck him with a disease, an intestinal disease that had to do with worms, and he actually had a very miserable death. But Pompey was assassinated. So he'll pitch his royal tents between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. When God brings judgment on the proud oppressors, no one shall be able to help them, nor even want to help them. Antiochus died of a strange illness in great agony. Pompey was assassinated. And the fact of the matter is the idea says that there's a time for these oppressors. But when that time is done, there is a designated end. Judgment will be decreed. And when that judgment is decreed, no one's going to be able to help them. If they don't repent, if they don't stop, it's going to happen. So again, the bottom line here of we just did chapter 11 is the accuracy of the scripture and the details of it are absolutely amazing. Tell me, were you not, if you stuck with me and didn't tune me out, were you not just amazed at how the scripture lined up verse per verse for what happened in history? Is that not just astounding in itself? It speaks to the accuracy of our Bible. It says that it's more than just a mythological document. It's not just a group of stories. And all of this is going to culminate in chapter 12, where we will end this lecture series, which I'm sure some of you are probably going, yay, finally. But the reality is it's going to culminate this, because 12 is just the continuation of 11, not near as long, but it's the continuation. And there's some pretty cool things that I'm hoping to show you in 12 that you may not be aware of that I'm really excited about to bring to you. But I hope that you've enjoyed 11 and that you saw how God works. And then there's also a couple of pointers in there for us. We have to understand why persecution comes, that the oppressors will finally face judgment. And it is our job to be willing to be tested and refined to the point of perfection. We have to stay faithful to our Lord, no matter what. And with that, we'll pray.